It is March the 29th, and we are continuing in our creation classes. Our last class before Pesach. The next class after this one will not be until the Sunday after Pesach, which is, I don't know, what's the date on that one?
18, 26.
We are on page 202. Pesach ends on a Thursday night. We should be able to have class on that Sunday night.
So, do you have a class next Sunday?
No, not next Sunday. This is the last class before Pesach.
Okay, we're all going to be having our hair pulled out the Sunday before Pesach.
We're not going to have class next Sunday.
Okay.
I won't be allowed out of the house next Sunday.
All right, so tonight's the last class until after Pesach.
Right.
I forgot my glasses. I have to run to my car.
Okay. Okay.
I have to wear these big, ugly sunglasses. So don't be.
I have no. 12th to 19th. Right. So that would be the 19th. That would be the next class.
Right.
Okay. Okay, so we're on page 202, and let's recap where we were last time. We had described Yaakov and Yosef, and talked about what Yaakov had in store for Yosef in going to Shechem to his brothers, and Yosef's acceptance of the task, and what was the whole setup with him going there. We said that this time we would focus on what the brother's perspective is. And we left off with, appropriately, four questions. Although they have nothing to do with the Pesach there.
We left off with some connection to Pesach.
Yeah, well, we'll tie it in a little bit to Pesach. But there were four things we left off with. One was, now we said the brothers were jealous of Yosef. And we wanted to know what was the nature of this jealousy, where we are accepting the fact that their jealousy is not going to be the same type of petty jealousy that we are all used to. So what is it that they are jealous of? After Yosef has his dreams, we talked about how the first dream they thought was nothing more than Yosef's own imagination running wild, but the second dream they didn't discount, and they accepted his dream as real. So then if it's divine in nature, so what are they jealous about? That was number one. Number two is that we read already, and we'll reread these psukim in a few moments, but we read that the brothers, when they saw Yosef coming, they wanted to kill him. Why do they want to kill him? Even if they are jealous of him, why kill him? What did he do to deserve to die, to be killed? That's number two. Number three is that Reuven, in his mind, the Torah tells us Reuven decides he's going to save Yosef. But he doesn't let on that he's going to save Yosef. He pretends to be with the brothers, but instead is attempting to save him. Why does he have to do this in a clandestine way? Why can't he come out with it and say his real opinion, which is that he will save Yosef? And finally, we saw there's a focus on boros, on pits. They want to kill him and throw him into a pit, into one of the pits. And instead, Reuven says, let's throw him into this pit. How many pits are there? What is the significance of the board of the pit? Those are the questions we're going to attempt to answer tonight. We, of course, are going to leave off with more questions because the story continues. But at least these four questions we're going to try to answer this evening. So let us read again, even though we read them last time, on page 202. Let's start with Pasuk Yud Ches, verse 18. ברוך אתה אדוני אלוהינו מלך העולם שהכל נהיה בדברו. So Yaakov has sent Yosef. Yosef, remember, he couldn't find his brothers. He met a man, which was Gavriel, in the field, and the man sent him to Dothan to find his brothers. Vayiru osam erachok, they saw him from afar. uveterem yikrav alehem, and before he got close to them, vayisnaklu oso lahamiso, and they plotted about him to kill him. They conspired, they say in English, against him to kill him. Vayomru ish elochiv, and one man said to his brother, hinei ba'al hachalomos halazeba, behold, the dreamer is coming. Ve'atai ne'al l'chuvena hargehu, let us go and let us kill him. V'nashlichehu be'achad haboros, we will throw him into one of the pits. Ve'amarnu, and we'll say, chaya ra'a achalashu, an evil animal ate him. V'nirem, we will see, mayu chalamosav, what will be with his dreams. V'yishma Reuven, and Reuven heard. V'yatzilehu miyadam, and he saved him from their hands. V'yomer, and he said, lo nakenu nafesh, we will not strike a soul. As we will not kill him. In English it says mortally. We won't kill him. Vayomer alehem Reuven, and Reuven said to them, al tishpuchu dam, don't spill blood. Hashlichu oso el habor hazeh asher bamidbar, throw him into this pit that is in the wilderness. V'yad al tishlichu vo, and a hand do not send against him. Leman hatzil oso miyadam, in order to save him from their hands. Lahashivo el aviv, to return him to his father. Now, there's no question that verse 18, you can read it allegorically, and there are those who would like to read the verse allegorically, not to reject the simple meaning, but you can also read it allegorically. Vayiru osame rachok, they saw him from afar, meaning they did not see him as a close brother, they saw him from a distance, they saw him as distant from them. Uveterem yikrav alehem, before he got close to them, before he had a chance to become close with them as brothers, vayisnaklu oso lahamiso, they plotted to kill him. But in the simple meaning, while they see him from a distance, and before he gets close, they are already planning to kill him. Which means that the Torah is making it clear to us, their intention to kill him has nothing to do with what he says when he gets there. Although we know from our discussion 2 weeks ago that Yosef knows that he has a very tough job ahead of him to try to get his brothers to accept him. But even before he opens his mouth, when they just see him coming, they've already decided to kill him. Vayomru ish elochiv, and in Pasuk Yotes, verse 19, a man said to his brother, Rashi, not over here, but later on, examines who are these two, one man to his brother. Who said to whom? So Rashi tells us that this is Shimon speaking to Levi. The way Rashi proves it is because Reuven, we know, doesn't want to kill him, so it can't be Reuven. And we will see, not this evening, but in the next verses, on page 204, we will see that Yehuda had other plans for Yosef, and Yehuda's plans end up carrying the day. So of the four oldest brothers, Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Reuven and Yehuda are already spoken for, that leaves Shimon and Levi. And Rashi tells us later on that the younger brothers would not have spoken ahead of their older brothers. And therefore, he deduces that these two are Shimon and Levi. This is the second time that we find Shimon and Levi acting as a team. When is the first time you find Shimon and Levi acting as a team?
With Dinah.
Where?
Shechem.
Where are they now?
Shechem.
Interesting. The same two people, Shimon and Levi, who are again acting as a team, and again, what they're about to do is not necessarily the best thing. With Shechem, they had a plan, but it contradicted what their father wanted. Here they have a plan, and it is to kill Yosef. And apparently it's not good either. Now, are they simply murderers? Is that they're just jealous, so they murder? Is that all it is? That they're just acting in anger and in jealousy? So one man says to his brother, Rashi tells us it's Shimon speaking to Levi. It's important to note this, even though we are right now not going to focus so much on Shimon and Levi, but there will come a time, please God, later on in Chumash, where we will examine very, very closely this relationship of Shimon and Levi. What is it that binds them together, and how is it that this this friendship of theirs, this, I don't want to use the word friendship, let's use this, the word brotherhood between them, shapes their future in a very, very significant way. And we'll talk about that probably in Parshas Vayechi. At any rate, Shimon says to Levi, behold, the dreamer, this dreamer has come. Behold, the dreamer has come. Now, he does not use his name. He doesn't say, behold, Yosef has come. They all know his name is Yosef. Why does he call him the dreamer? Behold, the dreamer has come. And now, let us go and let us kill him. And we'll throw him into one of the pits. And we will say, an evil animal has eaten him. And we will see what will be with his dreams. So, this plot to kill him is bookended by the dreams. Behold, here is the dreamer. Therefore, let us kill him. We'll throw him into one of the pits, and we'll say a wild animal, an evil animal, has eaten him. And we will see what will be with his dreams. Clearly, the Torah is telling us, is what is their motivation to kill him? The dreams. The dreams are what is getting them to want to kill him. It is the dreams.
The dreams make him, as this says, a leader. They didn't like that.
Okay, so the jealousy comes from the fact that he had the dreams, which puts him as the leader.
Rabbi, I may ask the question before, but how could the founder of the tribes, which we admire, be murderers?
Right. That's the question over here. What are they out to do? Right?
How can you say this are the, you know, the fathers of the tribe?
Right.
And they're murderers.
So that's an excellent question. And that is a question which we must answer this evening, because otherwise we can't move on. How is it possible that they're just common murderers? We can understand jealousy. We can all relate to.
Yes.
We've all been jealous. No one is spared from the malady of jealousy. We've all been intensely jealous at some time in our lives, if not many times in our lives. And we all can relate to what Shlomo HaMelech writes, King Solomon writes, that jealousy is rekev atzamos. It rots the bones. You can almost feel your bones rotting when you're jealous of someone else. You can almost feel it inside. You're eaten up inside. We can all relate to that. But none of us, thank God, can relate to murder. Right? None of us would murder. And even when we are very, very jealous, and we might even rejoice at someone else's downfall because we're so jealous of them, but we would never pull the trigger. That far we wouldn't go. So, how can it be that these great tribes, that they're the ones who would actually murder? And they really do want to do it. This is not empty talk. Yeah.
We have the presence, Cain and Hevel.
Okay.
And I think what's showing here is the godless, they were able to overcome it because of the precedent we have, Cain and Hevel.
Okay, so what you're saying is that our precedent for brotherhood jealousy is Cain and Hevel, is Cain and Abel. And there, Cain does kill Hevel. So what you're suggesting is that the default would be to commit murder. And if they can withstand the temptation to kill, that in fact is a great thing. Okay, but that would mean then that we're all greater than they were. Because they have this urge to kill, and we don't.
I know, but they didn't act on it.
Okay, it's true they didn't act on it. Now, it's also true that they have a lot more to lose than we do. Okay, but we're going to see if we can understand a little bit more than that.
Then how can you justify Cain?
What's that?
How can you justify Cain and Abel? He did kill.
Oh, you can't justify. He was wrong.
That's right.
Cain was wrong. He was punished for it.
I know you said here that the reason that they wanted to kill him was because of the dreams, but they were jealous of him before the dreams. They were jealous of him from Yaakov's attention.
True. That's true. But it's true. But when the Torah says, Vayekanu v'lachav, that the brothers were jealous of him, it says it after the dreams. It says... it's true, it says that the brothers saw, in Pasuk Dalet, verse 4, it says the brothers saw that their father loved him from all the brothers, and they hated him. The Torah doesn't say the words, and they were jealous of him. It says they hated him. Now, we understand that hatred came from jealousy, but it doesn't use the word jealousy. It uses the word jealousy after the dreams. That's where it says, Vayekanu v'lachav, in Pasuk Yudalet, verse 11. Yeah.
This doesn't have anything to do with the jealousy, but I'm curious to know, all the brothers went out to see after the sheep, but why did Joseph not go with them?
Well, we saw before that the brothers were deliberately trying to get away from Yosef.
Oh, okay.
That they were actually shepherding themselves. They were getting away from Yosef. They needed to get away and to think. and to cool down, to get away from what was going on. They needed to pull themselves out of their situation in order to figure out what to do next.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I had another thought. Because it doesn't mention Yosef by name, you know, mm-hmm. here comes the dreamer.
Mm-hmm.
It's an impersonal thing. That, like, they kind of detaching themselves from it, like, we have a right to feel this way, to do this action, because, you know, we don't want to feel so guilty or responsible. But on the other hand, it shows there must be a connection, because when Yosef left after his father asked him to go, he knew his brothers hated him,
mm-hmm.
and he went regardless, mm-hmm. even if he was, might be in danger.
That's right. So Yosef was, we talked about that last time, that Yosef was willing to take the risk.
But I think there's something more. It elevated him to a different person than what he
okay.
was.
Okay. You mean that he's different now than he was before? Okay, perhaps. Our sages tell us that the last words in Pasuk Chaf, in verse 20, were not said by the brothers. The brothers said, let us go and let us kill him, and we'll throw him into one of the pits, and we'll say an evil animal has eaten him. That's the end of their statement. And then it is Hashem who wrote in the Torah, and we'll see what happens to his dreams. In other words, you're trying to undermine his dreams. Let's see whose plan wins. You, brothers, you have a plan to undermine his dreams, which is to kill him. And my plan is to make his dreams come true. Okay, so we have a contest. You against me. Let's see who wins. And we all know, of course, that God is going to win. So it is Hashem writing these words. I don't want to say sarcastically, because Hashem is not sarcastic, but it's the way we would have said it sarcastically. Let's see what happens. Mm-hmm. Right? Okay. So here we have to understand a little bit more of what the brother's perspective is. Remember that Yosef is of the youngest of the tribes. He's number 11 out of 12. Yosef, 11 out of 12. He's the 11th out of 12. Right. Now, Yosef, as we have already pointed out, was acting as a na'ar. He was acting as a lad. Even though he was 17 years old, he wasn't a young boy, but he was acting as a lad. And even though we explained that that does not mean the juvenile way that our 17-year-olds act, or, if we want to really admit it, the way we acted when we were 17. That's not the way he was acting. He wasn't that juvenile. But relative to who Yosef was meant to be, and who the brothers were, he was acting in a juvenile way. Meaning relative to what the level he was on, he had not fully what's the best way to explain it? He had not fully taken control of that position. His position was to be the leader of the brothers. And in fact, we know in the end he will be the leader of the brothers. In fact, he'll be the leader of the entire known world by the time his career is over. He dies as the viceroy of Egypt, which controls the entire known world of that time. And so that's where he's going to end up. And that's what Yosef is destined to be. However, at this point, he has not grown into the position yet. He has these dreams, and although that may be his destiny, but the way that he projects himself is what causes the jealousy. Although the brothers should not have been jealous, but the blame also rests with Yosef, because he projected himself in a way that encouraged jealousy, that encouraged alienation. The brothers were very fearful of Yosef. Why were they fearful of Yosef? Let's think of the perspective of the brothers. We are now the brothers. Let's think of what our immediate history is. We know that we come from Avraham and Sarah, Yitzchak and Rivka, Yaakov and Leah. Because Rachel was the mother of Yosef and Binyamin. Right. Yaakov and Leah. We know we come from these illustrious people. We know that we are supposed to be the Jewish people. That these are the patriarchs and the matriarchs. The age of patriarchs is over. As the Gemara says, Ein Korin Avos Ela Shlosha. There are only three Avos, only three fathers. This, of course, relates to the Pesach Seder. We say three are the fathers and four are the mothers. Right? Shlosha Avos and Arba Imahos. There are no more. No one else is called an Av. No one else is called an Aim. They are the patriarchs and the matriarchs. There's no fourth generation. That's it. There's three generations of patriarchs and matriarchs, which means their children are going to be the Jewish people. We as the tribes understand that. Now we look back in our history and we say to ourselves, well, let's think. Avraham had two sons. He had Yishmael and he had Yitzchak. And what happened to Yishmael? Okay, he was cast aside. The line does not go through Yishmael, the line goes through Yitzchak. Yitzchak had two sons, Yaakov and Esav. What happened to Esav? Esav was cast aside, the line goes through Yaakov. Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov. To be sure, Yishmael claims that he too has some connection to this center stage of history, because he comes from Avraham, and we say no, he doesn't. Esav claims that he has rights to the center stage of history because he comes from Avraham and Yitzchak, and we say no, he doesn't. Now Yaakov has children, and he has 12 sons and a daughter. And the understanding is that all 12 will forge the Jewish people. And that's the way the brothers grew up. They grew up with this perspective. And here, when Yosef is the age of 17, they begin to see in Yosef a different perspective. They begin to see Yosef projecting himself as being not the leader of the Jewish people, because if you have 12 people, someone's got to lead. You're going to have one person who's going to be the king. You're going to have one person who's going to be the Kohen. You're going to have another person who's going to be the Talmud Chacham, the Torah scholar. You're going to have another person who's going to be the businessman. You're going to have different strengths and weaknesses amongst the 12. So that's understandable. To be the leader is acceptable. But that's not what they were seeing in Yosef. They were seeing in Yosef that there was going to be an us and a them. There was going to be an in and an out. There was going to be part of the clan and those who were going to be cast away. What they were seeing was a repeat of the previous generations. That Yosef was not projecting himself as being one of them, only the leader, but rather as being somehow superior to them, as somehow being and on a different plane of existence to them. That it would be Yosef and everybody else. Were they right or were they wrong? In fact, our sages tell us, we find that Yosef ends up having how many sons?
Two.
He has two. Ephraim and Menashe. Menashe and Ephraim. Binyamin, we will see later, has 10 sons. Our sages tell us that ultimately Yosef was meant to have 12 sons. Because he only ended up with two, Binyamin had the other 10. We'll talk about that hopefully at a later date. Our sages tell us that Yosef's life in many ways mimicked his father Yaakov. Yaakov was hated by his brother. Yosef was hated by his brothers. Yaakov had 12 tribes. Yosef was supposed to have 12 tribes. Our sages tell us Yaakov was supposed to be dragged down to Egypt in chains to fulfill the prophecy that Avraham had in the Bris Ben Abisarim, in the covenant between the parts that he had with God. But instead, Yosef took his place. Yosef, in many ways, replaces Yaakov. We also showed that Yosef is not just a regular brother. Yosef is the bridge between Av and Ben, between father and son. We spoke about this at an earlier date. He is called Evan Yisrael. Evan is a contraction of Av and Ben, father and son. Yosef, his sons become tribes. The other sons, the other brothers, their sons don't become tribes. They themselves are tribes. But Yosef's two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, themselves become tribes. Which means Yosef in some way is really an Av. Even though he's not really an Av, because there are only three avos. We don't say in Shmona Esrei, we don't say Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov, Elokei Yosef. We don't say that. They don't add Yosef in as a fourth patriarch. But nevertheless, he's got his foot in both camps. He straddles the fence. He's sort of a father, sort of a son. That's very threatening to the brothers. And it's very tricky. It's very tricky for Yosef to present that in the proper way. On the one hand, the person who is both Av and Ben has to project himself as being one of them, one of the brothers, one of the boys. At the same time, he has to be a little bit aloof as being somehow apart from them as the father. A father isn't one of the boys. A father is an authority figure. And Yosef has to somehow straddle the fence, and it's a very difficult thing to do. Yosef, at this point in his life, was not doing it effectively. And what they were picking up from his behavior is, he's going to force us out. He's going to dismiss us. He's going to take control of Yiddishkeit, of Judaism. There will be Yosef and his children. They will be the Jews, and we will be cast away, like Esav, like Ishmael. That is the way they interpreted or understood Yosef's behavior. As a result, they sat in judgment to decide what to do. What do we do based on these facts? Shimon and Levi arrived at the following conclusion based on the following logic. The Torah tells us, Haba lahargecha, if someone is coming to kill you, hashkem lahar go. Get up and kill him first. Preemptive strike. A preemptive strike was not created in 1967. It is a law in the Torah. The Torah tells us that's what you're supposed to do. The law is brought out in the case of Abba Machteres, that if someone breaks into somebody's home, if someone breaks into someone's home in a, doesn't just walk into an open door, but if someone actually has to, the way the Torah tells it is he has to dig a tunnel under the home, but he has to break into a home, the Torah says you are allowed to kill that man. You can shoot that man first. Even if he does not aim a gun at you, you can shoot him, shoot first, ask questions later. The Gemara says, why should you shoot him? He's coming to steal money. He's not coming to kill. The Gemara says, anybody who goes through that kind of trouble to get into a home, and everybody knows that a typical homeowner will not simply stand by and let you take his things. But if you try to take somebody's things, they're going to try to stop you. If someone goes through that kind of trouble to get into somebody's home, you can be sure they have come to kill. You can be sure that they know the consequences. They know the homeowner is going to try to stop them, and they're ready to kill in order to get that person's things. If a person walks into an open door, not necessarily. You know, it could be just saw an opportunity and he ran the door. You know, oh, the door's open. I may as well run and try to grab something. Then you don't know that he's come to kill. But if he has to go through effort to break into a home, the Torah says, you know that person is ready to kill. And if that person is ready to kill, even if his weapon is not drawn, you shoot first. You ask questions later. That's what the Torah says. Preemptive strike. The brothers said, Yosef's out to kill. What? Not physically kill, but he's out to write us off. He's out to cast us away. And Yosef has the power to do it. Because Yosef has the ear of Yaakov. Yosef has the coat. Yosef has the dreams. The dreams are divine. The brothers understood that the dreams were divine. The brothers weren't doubting the dreams. But what do you do with the dreams? Yes, they understood that Yosef did have a special role to play, one of leadership. But Yosef can use that power and let it corrupt himself. He can take those dreams and use them for his own benefit rather than for the service of God. And they understood that that's what he was out to do. Therefore, Shimon and Levi paskened, they ruled that Yosef is chayav misa. He is liable. He is liable for death. He deserves to be killed. They weren't doing this out of anger. They weren't letting their emotions get the best of them. This was an intellectual decision. Now, it was a wrong decision. It was incorrect. Nevertheless, it was an intellectual decision. They decided based on Yosef's behavior, that now Yosef must be killed. And that's why they said, here's the dreamer, the one who is going to take those dreams and he's going to use them against us. He needs to be killed. That was their decision. Now, they were wrong. Reuven is going to save them. So we'll discuss Reuven in a moment. Yes, question.
The only real behavior that Yosef shows to be so inimical to the brothers is that he's telling tales to his father. Is it so? Is there a fault in the brothers for thinking so extremely?
It's more than that. He's also telling the dreams over and over again. Remember how he told the dreams and told them again in front of his brothers?
Right.
His father had to yell at him because he was bringing jealousy upon himself. And he was not dealing with the dreams in a way that would have brought the brothers in. Instead, he was saying to them in a way that would alienate the brothers. Now, we already talked about Yosef. Yosef was not doing this because he was trying to elicit jealousy, but that is what was happening. Yeah?
Rabbi, based on what you said, that the Torah implies that we should carry weapons. And I don't believe in carrying weapons.
No, the Torah does not anywhere say that you should carry a weapon. But it does mean that if someone is breaking into a home, then you have to be aware the person is ready to kill. Don't treat that person as if they're just a petty thief. Because a pickpocket is not necessarily out to kill. But someone who breaks into a home, that person is a dangerous criminal. That person is out to kill. So if you have a weapon, the Torah is saying shoot first. If you don't have a weapon, get away. But don't confront the person, because that person will kill. That's what the Torah is warning.
Is that legal in our society?
I have no idea. And I'm not going there. I'm not going there.
This is in Texas, I'll think of it.
I will only say...
Yeah, you got to have a gun.
I will only say that I was once advised by a lawyer... I do not own a weapon. A gun, anyway. But I was once told... I was once advised by a lawyer who was a good friend of mine that if, in fact, a homeowner does shoot a thief who breaks into the home, make sure you kill and not just wound. Because if you wound, you'll get a lawsuit against you. If you kill, you'll be safe.
Well, just for
that's the fallacy of our system. Yes?
Just for the record, there are 23 states, and Georgia is one of them, where you can kill somebody who breaks into your house.
Okay.
What did you say? It's okay.
In Georgia.
It wasn't changed like this.
Well, if we get arrested, we'll call you.
You call my friend, not me.
Do you have a weapon?
No.
I'm not at liberty to discuss.
No one's breaking into this classroom. Okay. Now, Reuven disagrees. Reuven does not agree with this conclusion. As the verse says, in Chafal 21, Vayishma Reuven heard, Vayatzilehu miyadam, and he saved him from their hand. Vayomer, and he said, Lo na kenu nafesh. Now, let's follow carefully what Reuven says and what he's actually thinking. So Reuven says, we will not strike a soul. Or we will not strike a soul mortally. We won't kill him. Lo na kenu nafesh. We will not strike him. Now, Reuven didn't say don't kill him. Reuven said, we will not strike him mortally. And as they were ready to actually kill him, however it would be, with a sword, with a dagger, they were ready to kill him, to physically use a weapon and kill him. Reuven says, we will not strike someone mortally. We're not going to do that. That's statement number one. Now, very interestingly, in verse 22, Pasuk Chaf Beis, Vayomer Alehem Reuven, Reuven said to them. Now, it said already in the previous pasuk, Vayomer, he said, Lo na kenu nafesh, we will not strike a soul. And then it says, Vayomer alehem Reuven. Reuven said to them, Al tishpichu dam, don't spill blood. Well, didn't Reuven already start talking?
Maybe he was talking to himself.
Okay, so right, see, the word Vayomer is used twice. He said. So one possibility is that he was talking, the first statement was not to the brothers. It doesn't say to them. It just says, and he said, we will not strike a soul. Then the next statement is, and Reuven said to them, don't spill blood. That's possible, that's what's going on. If we're to understand it that way, then what's happening is this. Reuven's conviction is, we will not strike a soul. Now, that's fine. But how are you going to sell that? How are you going to sell that to the brothers? We won't strike a soul. Fine, we won't strike a soul, but you can't just say that. They're not going to listen to you. What are you going to say that's going to convince them not to strike a soul? So then, Reuven said it in the way that will sell what he wants. Meaning, there's two things. There is the ideal. There's the goal, which you're trying to get to. But then there's the way that you try to get others to get there. They're not simply going to listen to you just because you say it. So the first thing is, what's my goal? My goal is, we will not strike a soul. Next, Reuven said to them, don't spill blood. Rather, throw him into this pit that is in the wilderness. And don't send your hand against him. So Reuven gives them an alternative. Don't strike him. Rather, I understand you want to kill him, and I'm not arguing with you, but don't hit him. Don't use your hand against him. Rather, throw him in the pit. He'll die on his own in the pit. That's what Reuven is telling them. And the Torah tells us, but in reality, what was Reuven thinking? Lemana tzilaso miyadam, in order to save him from their hands, lahashivo el aviv, to return him to his father. So there's three things going on over here. There's what Shimon and Levi want to do, which is kill him with their hands. There's what Reuven suggests to them, which is don't stand your hand against him, rather throw him in the pit and he'll die that way. That way you will not have actually sent your hand against him. He would have died on his own. And third is what Reuven's really thinking, which is, I'll come back later and get him out of the pit. Which is what he's going to try to do, and by then he will have already been sold. But that's what Reuven wants to do. Okay. Now, let's just take this theme of the pits first before we examine Reuven a little bit more closely. They said, in Pasuk Chaf in verse 20, we will kill him, and we will throw him in one of the pits. Now, what are we going to tell our father? We threw him in one of the pits. Now what? Are we going to go home and tell our father, we killed him, we threw him in one of the pits? We're not going to tell him that. So we'll say, an evil animal has eaten him. How do they translate that? They say, a wild beast devoured him. Okay. An evil animal has eaten him. Reuven says, throw him, don't spill blood. Throw him into this pit that's in the wilderness. So, which pit? What's this pit? Now, the pit they're going to throw him into, we will read later on that the Torah tells us, let's jump ahead over here, even though we're not going to read these verses now in depth. But jump ahead to Pasuk Chaf Daleth to 24. Vayikachuhu vayashlichu oso habora. They took him, they threw him into the pit. Vehabor reik, the pit was empty, ein bo mayim, there was no water in it. Now before we say what many of you said before, that the Gemara says about this verse, what do you see from this verse about a typical pit? What does a typical pit have in it?
Water.
Water. Yeah. Most pits in the wilderness have water. That's what you find in most of these pits. There are two types of wells in the Torah. There is a be'er, that's the most common word for well, and there is bor, another word for well. The difference is, a be'er is a well where the water comes from below, where there is a spring or an underground stream, and you dig a deep pit, a be'er, and you reach that water, and there's a source of water underneath this be'er. That's what a be'er means. It's a natural source of water under the ground. A bor, typically in the Torah, is also a water hole, but it is the water comes from the rain. There's no water source underneath. It's just a deep pit, and it catches rainwater. And so typically, these pits have water in them. That's usually what you find in these pits. Of course, they could dry out, but normally that's what you're going to find in these pits. You're going to find water. This one had no water. That's very significant. Why is that very significant? Because Reuven was trying to suggest to them, don't send your hand against him. Now, is there, legally, a difference between shooting someone in the head or throwing someone into water and having them drown?
Shouldn't be.
He may not drown. Of course, if the water is deep.
I mean, if there's no way for him to get out, right? If you tie someone up, and put some lead around their feet and throw them in the water. Is there any difference between that and shooting them in the head? It's the same murder. It's murder like anything else is murder. That's first-degree murder. That's what it is. And the Torah does not differentiate between the two. A person is liable for the death penalty if they do either one of those things. Yes?
But Rabbi, it implies that it must have been a deep pit where he couldn't climb out.
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't that equate throwing him into water
anything? Excellent. Okay. So the Gemara tells us this was a very deep pit. It was a pit that was at least 20 amos deep. 20 amos, 20 cubits. An amma is, there are different opinions how long an amma is. It is between a foot and a half and 2 feet. So a 20 amma pit is no shallower than 30 feet deep. It may have been 40 feet deep, but that's how deep it was. So it was very deep, but there was no water in the pit. That they knew. There was no water in the pit. So they were not throwing it in to drown. They were throwing him in to simply be there, and eventually he would die.
How did they know there was no water to save him?
Yeah, I don't know. God. I'm not sure how they knew.
Maybe they threw it. I get the feeling that Reuben is trying to make him better of himself. Instead of totally being able to hide their ways of trying to get rid of them.
Mm-hmm.
He's just giving sort of advice.
Okay, so he's doing what he knows can be listened to. If he just says don't do it,
right,
they're not going to listen.
But he himself hasn't really done anything.
Right,
other
he wants,
than, yes.
Because he wants
and
to save them.
Just telling them what not to do.
Right, okay. Now this pit that has no water in it, the Gemara tells us there was no water in it, but there were snakes and scorpions in it. However, the Mefarshim tell us, the commentaries say, the brothers couldn't see the snakes and scorpions because it was so deep. The water they knew wasn't there, as was suggested, perhaps they threw a stone in, and they knew there was no water. But they could not see that there were dangerous snakes and scorpions on the bottom of the pit. They miraculously left Yosef alone. That was a miracle that God did for Yosef, that they did not bother him. So here you have a deep pit with no water, but yes, with snakes and scorpions, and they're going to throw them in this pit. Now, here's where you get a nuance in the law. You see, there is a difference between murder, which is direct murder, and murder, which is indirect murder. Both are murder. But one is first-degree murder, and then there's second-degree murder. There's where you're further removed from what happens. The Torah, just as in secular law, there is a difference between a direct murder and an indirect murder. That is true in the Torah law as well. Both are prohibited. And you see, in Torah law, we have the advantage over secular law, which is, they always have the default, which is, don't worry, God will get him anyway. Right? You always have that. You can't get away with anything in Torah law. But as far as our court system is concerned, there has to be standards. You can't just say any murder gets a death penalty. Well, I mean, what's called murder? What's not called murder? You have to have some system. What if someone is, God forbid, driving a car and loses control and hits somebody? They're going to get killed for that? But they were speeding. But they shouldn't have been speeding. But they didn't mean to kill. Like, how are you going to? At what point do you draw the line? It's not. It's very murky. What do you call real murder or not?
If you can say that she just fell on the speed.
That's what?
If he really would die, so...
That's what they could claim.
Yes, she could claim that she just fell.
Right, they could claim it.
No one put it here.
That's not what Reuven is saying. Reuven is saying, don't send your hand against him. What is he trying to tell them? Don't commit first-degree murder. I understand you want to kill him. I'm not arguing with you. But it is not appropriate to kill him directly. You want to kill him, throw him in the pit. Eventually, he will die. Somehow or other, either he will die of starvation, or he will, something while he was... He's not taking away from the fact that he's going to die. Reuven is not dissuading them from killing him. He is dissuading them from killing him directly. Do it indirectly. And they listen to him. They listen to him. They do not want to kill him directly once Reuven says not to do it. And they listen to him. They do, eventually, as we will see, they will throw him into the pit. Reuven's intention is to come back later and get him. But he has at least convinced them, don't kill him directly. Yes?
Did Reuben not agree with the rest of the brothers that Joseph was a danger to them?
Yes, and we're going to talk about that in a moment. Yes.
Rabbi, I'm not an attorney, but there's got to be, you know, if you threw somebody into a 30-foot pit, that has to be first-degree murder.
If he dies from the fall.
No, if you just left him there in a 30-foot pit, I can't understand that wouldn't be a first-degree murder.
I don't know in secular law what it would be. In Torah law, that will be a second-degree murder. It will be a second-degree murder because the murder takes a long time. The process of the murder takes longer. The person does not, and theoretically, right now, every single person in this room is starving to death because we haven't eaten. So we've started the process of starving to death, right? Theoretically. But that's not true. None of us are starving to death, thank God. So you don't say a person is starving to death from the moment they stop eating. So when does starving to death begin? It doesn't begin until the person really begins to need the food. So if they throw him in the pit now, and he doesn't need the food for another 6 hours, so he hasn't begun the process of being killed yet, not for another 6 hours. So there is a time lapse between what they do and the time that the actual murder begins. It's still murder, and as I said, God would get them if he would have died. But legally, there is a difference.
Well, two things. Yeah. First of all, if you throw somebody in a pit and you expect that he's going to die because there's not food or water or anything like that, but he may die from something else. He may die because, unbeknownst to you, he might have some kind of blood disease or something that kills him before he would die of starvation.
Okay.
So that's one thing. And the other thing is, if you shoot somebody and you kill them, they are dead instantly, and you see that they are dead, and it was intentional, and you have killed them. But if you throw somebody in a pit, you don't see that person dying or dead.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always the possibility, even though it's very, very remote, there's always the possibility that that person may somehow
survive.
Be saved.
Okay.
Be saved. Someone could come along and he could shout.
Which is what ends up happening. Right? That ends up happening. He ends up being saved. Now, that is an excellent point. You see, what Reuven was doing, why do they listen to Reuven? Why shouldn't they kill him? What was Reuven, why would they listen to him?
He's the youngest brother.
It's true, but he knew they wouldn't listen if he said, don't kill him. What Reuven was doing was, he was injecting the element of doubt. You see, what Reuven was doing is, he was saying to them, look, you say to kill him. I'm with you. How do you know that we're 100% right? Maybe the reason why we decided to kill him is because we're jealous. We all agree we're jealous. So we're not really impartial. Maybe that's tainting our thought process. Who says that we have paskined correctly, that we have ruled correctly? It would be presumptuous of us to carry out the death penalty because maybe we're wrong. You know, when the courts have to rule on a capital crime, they deal with it as impartially as possible. They try to remain as aloof as possible, as removed as possible from the personalities, because the courts can't deal with personalities, then you wouldn't have law. God can deal with personalities. The courts have to deal with the facts at hand. Was there a murder or wasn't there a murder? Over here, it's impossible for them to be objective. They're brothers. So therefore, Reuven says to them, let's keep our hands out of this. Throw them in the pit. Because if you throw them in the pit, there is an element of doubt, as Dottie said. And therefore, maybe there will be some divine intervention to save him, which will prove that we're wrong. If God saves him, then it'll prove that we're wrong. Let's not be the ones to carry it out. Now, they didn't simply say to him, okay, you're free to go, and if God wants you dead, he'll kill you. That they didn't do. They did put him in a situation where he will likely die, but not necessarily. So that, they agreed with him. When Reuven said that to them, they agreed. But Reuven had another thing in mind. So again, they said, we're going to kill him outright. Reuven convinced them, don't do that, let's have an element of doubt. What was Reuven really thinking? He was really thinking, leman hatzilo som miyadam la'ashivo el aviv, in order to save him from their hands, to return him to his father. So Rashi tells us that why did Reuven not want to kill him? So Rashi says, Reuven said, I'm going to read you the Rashi and I'll translate. Ani Bechor, I am the firstborn. V'gadol shebekulan, I'm the oldest one of all of them. Lo yitla hasirchon ela bi, the sirchon, which means the, let's go look for that. I guess we'll use the word responsibility. It's a little bit, the word really means something a little bit sharper than responsibility, but it'll be on me. In other words, it's going to be my fault. Ultimately, his death will be pinned on me. I will be at fault. Reuven here did what the oldest son is supposed to do. Reuven stood up and took responsibility. Reuven said, I'm the oldest, I'm responsible. And in my mind, I have to take responsibility to return him to his father. We cannot take this into our hands. You see, because Reuven held, really, he held his position much more strongly than he let on. Again, what he told his brothers is, maybe we're subjective. Maybe we're not really objective. Let's leave some chance up to it. But you know what Reuven really thought? He thought, we're definitely subjective. Our ruling is definitely wrong. We cannot be the ones to carry this out at all. Not directly, but not even indirectly. We can't be the ones to do it. That would be taking the law into our own hands, which is wrong because we are too subjective. They were not ready to hear it. Why was Reuven ready to take that step and they weren't? The Torah is telling us, or Rashi is telling us, what set Reuven apart from Shimon and Levi? Why didn't he say the same thing as they did? And the answer is...
his repentance because of Bilhah.
Well, we'll get to that in a minute. But because he was taking responsibility. Now, what Linda's pointing out, which is very important, is that, remember, Reuven has already compromised his birthright because he moved the beds. And remember, we already learned that later on, Yaakov is going to tell Reuven on Yaakov's deathbed that because you did that, Reuven, therefore you will not be the king, therefore you will not be the Kohen. Reuven has lost certain parts of the birthright because he was impetuous. He was too quick to act. Nevertheless, here Reuven takes responsibility. You see from here that Reuven was not a person who simply threw up his hands and said, forget it, I'm a failure. Yes, he did something wrong, but you see over here that he was still taking responsibility. I had a Rebbe who once said,